Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today we're going to be talking about In These Times, the Chicago-based weekly newspaper that just experienced its 25th anniversary or birthday. And with me here in the studio to talk about In These Times and to talk about a new book that's come out celebrating 25 years of In These Times called Appeal to Reason is the managing editor of In These Times, Craig Aaron. Craig?
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, welcome to the show. And I must say, Craig has graciously driven down to Urbana from his home in Chicago to join us in the studio. So this is a pre-recorded show. We're doing this a day or two before we're going on air, so please don't call him today. Just sit back, turn up the volume, have some tea, and enjoy the show. A lot of our listeners, I suspect, aren't familiar with In These Times, Craig. What is it? What's its history?
Well, In These Times is comes out of a biweekly magazine published out of Chicago. As you mentioned, we just celebrated our 25th anniversary. It was founded in 1976. At that time, a weekly newspaper, socialist newspaper.
It came out as a socialist paper originally.
It was the Independent Socialist Weekly was how it was billed. The magazine was founded back in 76 by James Weinstein, a fairly prominent left historian. And when Jim decided to start the magazine, he modeled it on a publication called The Appeal to Reason. The Appeal to Reason was a newspaper published out of a small town called Girard, Kansas. Around 1912, it reached its peak of about 750,000 subscribers. It featured Mother Jones, Eugene Debs. It was the publication
Upton Sinclair.
Upton Sinclair.
In fact, Upton Sinclair had his own page in the magazine. It was called Upton Sinclair's Page.
That's right, and they serialized The Jungle. They were the ones to do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're obviously a very successful or, you know, they're a wide-reaching publication. So, you know, in 1976, at a time when Jim Weinstein thought that the left was on the verge of returning to prominence.
I hope he didn't invest any money in that idea.
Just a little bit. It's not there anymore, though,
yeah,
that's
okay.
For sure. So he founded the magazine to be, you know, he was actually living in San Francisco at the time. He had worked on a publication then called Socialist Revolution, now called Socialist Review. I think it's still around. And
it's probably called something more like Democratic Review now. I think
exactly.
It's toned down every decade.
That's right. Now it's just the Independent Discussion, I think. anyway, he came in and he intentionally moved to the Midwest to start a publication with a Midwestern sensibility, one that could speak to, you know, everybody, union members, academics, you know, sort of a broad pragmatic left is really what he was envisioning. And, you know, as that movement grew, he, you know, envisioned In These Times to be the paper
the appeal to reason of this new
left or whatever it was then. Of course, it didn't quite work out that way. And,
no, it didn't.
You know, as the left really struggled, the magazine at various times struggled as well. Mm-hmm. But sort of in that time, it sort of found its niche, which was as a sort of plain-talking, investigative magazine that was very dedicated to covering the labor movement, the environment, the African-American community, and really became a place where you could get news and information that you couldn't get anywhere else that wasn't in the mainstream, you know, and then it has joined, you know, like-minded publications, The Nation, The Progressive, and Mother Jones, similar publications in trying to provide that sort of alternative view.
You mentioned those publications. How would you compare In These Times to The Nation or The Progressive?
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, In These Times shines in some ways. I mean, it's certainly compared to The Nation with having a Midwestern sensibility, which with its real focus on reporting and news when it's at its best.
Is that a Midwestern thing?
Oh, I don't know. I'm skipping around a little bit.
Oh, that's all right. But I like that. I'll take credit for it. We all will.
But, I mean, I think there's a plain talk. I think there's a talk about things that aren't happening in New York City. Where often I think a lot of particularly left publications tend to get lost in some of the academic discussions, if you will, that go on there and that maybe don't affect average people. And I think In These Times has tried to, you know, while certainly recognizing some of those important discussions, also to be a little bit more plain spoken, a little bit more newsy, focused on reporting and, you know, reporting across the globe, you know, and very much really dedicated to more hard news than just opinion pieces.
And then The Progressive, which is another Heartland publication.
Sure.
Based near to us in Madison, Wisconsin. How would you compare In These Times to that?
Well, I mean, I think they're very close. It's probably the two publications do have a lot of similarities. The Progressive certainly benefits from a long history in Wisconsin and tied to, you know, the progressive movement there, you know, 90 years or something at this point. But, you know, I think In These Times has the benefit of coming out more often and therefore, you know, can be a little bit more on top of the news. I think it probably has a greater commitment to covering the labor movement for sure. Through David Moberg is the reporter that we use and have used for, you know, the entire history of the magazine. We have a guy named Salim Wakil, who some of your listeners may be familiar with from his column in the Chicago Tribune. And he's, you know, really covered the—
Is he in the Tribune?
He's in the Tribune every Monday now.
He used to be in the Sun-Times.
He used to be, used to be in the Sun-Times.
All right,
he
got in a bidding war.
Right. Well, Lord Conrad Black, your friend and mine, came in and such views weren't quite as welcome.
Yeah, that'll happen.
Sort of strange that he ended up at the Tribune. I guess Colonel McCormick is probably rolling over in his grave every Monday.
But, I think he probably does every day.
Yeah, at this point.
Yeah, he's at 360.
But so, I mean, I think that's, you know, how In These Times has sort of differentiated itself, you know, when it's been at its best has really been through the investigative reporting and, you know, and through those voices, the Salim Wakil, David Moberg, Joel Blyfus, and the people that it's really highlighted over the years.
You know, one of the problems that publications like In These Times, The Nation, The Progressive all face is that the marketplace is not especially welcoming to socialist left-wing critical publications are critical of capitalism. And because of that, they have trouble getting advertising. They have trouble raising money to do distribution. Have those problems faced in these times?
Yes, they certainly have. They've been
that was a rhetorical question.
Yes, that's what we call. Yeah, I mean, it's a constant struggle. I mean, I think any political publication, there isn't a political publication out there that turns a profit. The Nation may claim to turn a profit, but that's only by some fuzzy math, if you will.
I don't think they really claim to either.
Right, yeah. It's sort of an inside joke, really. Yeah. But, I mean, of course, there's a big difference when you have, you know, Rupert Murdoch backing your failing publication like the Weekly Standard does versus, you know, the left, which obviously doesn't benefit because it's not supporting the corporate objectives from that kind of support.
Are there any wealthy left-wing philanthropists who have written sort of blank checks to say, we like what you're doing, keep it up?
Well, I mean, there are no blank checks, but there certainly have been some substantial checks that we've received over the years. In These Times is a publication where more than half of our budget actually comes from our readers. So our readers, donors, and sustainers are really what keep the publication
small
going.
Small donors for the most part.
Right. So. Something like a third of our readers give above and beyond the cost of a subscription. A subscription costs, you know, $20 a year. Some people give $100 a year. Some give $10,000 a year. But it really is those readers who rely or have come to rely on the magazine that have kept it going for 25 years. I mean, the magazine simply wouldn't have gone anywhere without them.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580. Our guest is Craig Aaron, the managing editor of the Chicago-based newspaper In These Times and also the editor of the new book that's just come out, Appeal to Reason, 25 Years of In These Times, published by Seven Stories Press. And we're going to be talking about that book on the show. But first, we want to talk a little bit more about the magazine, the newspaper In These Times, and its history before we get into the book. What are some of the biggest stories you think that In These Times has broken over its 25 years?
Well, one that really stands out for me would have been its coverage of the Iran-Contra scandal. I think that In These Times was a publication that was out front on a lot of those stories and really was at its best because it was pushing forward stories when the mainstream media really didn't want to have anything to do with them. With the corruption and crimes being committed by the Reagan administration. So
I'm going to date you here, Craig, but I think we might have some listeners who the Iran-Contra is ancient history. They might not even be familiar with it. Why don't you just give a one or two sentence thumbnail of what that refers to?
Basically, the Reagan administration was using money from arms sales. They were essentially selling arms to the Iranians and then funneling money to the Contra army, which was the Nicaraguan army that was fighting the elected Sandinista government during the 80s. Congress, of course, had passed laws saying that the Reagan administration could not give this army any money, that there was going to be no funding, federal government support. But the administration covertly, funneled money to buy arms and weapons. And that sort of spun off Oliver North, obviously, being sort of the poster child, if you will, for what happened during that period. But that, you know, sort of spun off a whole group of side scandals. One would obviously be the Dark Alliance thing that Gary Webb is most famous for uncovering, which was the fact that a lot of those planes were going down there with guns and coming back with cocaine. Another one would be what's called the October Surprise, which are the allegations, a story that In These Times actually broke, the allegations that the Reagan administration secretly met with Iranian officials before the 1980 election so that and negotiated with them to not release the hostages being held in Tehran at the time until after the election so that Jimmy Carter wouldn't get a boost.
Is that true, do you think? Would you buy the October Surprise?
In all the evidence I've seen, I certainly think there's a very, very strong circumstantial case. I think all of the evidence certainly points in the direction that somebody was there having discussions. Mm-hmm. Certainly the various investigations and reports that the government has done, while sort of on the surface may have said that that nothing happened there, when you sort of dig deep into the fine print, there's actually even more evidence that substantiates the case.
Okay, well, what about currently? What's sort of the last few issues, the last few months now under your reign, the Aaron years at In These Times? Well, have you been treating the great stories of our times? I mean, we start with, say, the 2000 election, moving ahead to 9/11 and the war on terrorism. And now, of course, the spectacular, really, if not unprecedented, certainly unusual corporate scandals and mm-hmm, crises. Mm-hmm. How's In These Times covering these?
Well, we're hopefully all over the stories. I think certainly In These Times is at a point where it feels like it's as important as ever because so much has happened in the last few years. You know, like you say, starting with the 2000 election, I'd like to think that this is really a moment where the magazine has stood out because the mainstream media has failed so completely to question what's going on, you know, whether it's in counting all the votes in Florida, whether it's, you know, what are the objectives being served by, you know, bombing Afghanistan at the level we've done. With the you know, scandals just every day, it seems like there's something new coming out of Washington, whether it's who knew what before September 11th, whether it's, you know, what's happening with civil liberties, and whether it's certainly these corporate scandals where, you know, not only the Democratic Party nowhere to be seen on these issues, the mainstream media basically nowhere to be seen on these issues, and the administration in both September 11th and now in the corporate scandals have positioned themselves where they're above criticism, where they'd like to be above criticism, you know, saying, well, we've got to come together now. I mean, we saw it with the war and all of the, you know, jingoism and everything associated with that, that if you dared question the objectives or even the way things were being carried out, then you were a traitor. And having very successfully done that, I think you're seeing the administration now treat the corporate scandals the same way, that we now need to come together as a country because there's all these bad things happening at these companies, you know, where it's almost a instead of what are very clearly policy decisions that we should be debating, that we should be questioning. And In These Times has tried to do that.
Well, what are some of the stories along these lines that you've actually been pushing that have been carried in the magazine, that have been pushing stuff that mainstream newspapers and journalism have not been covering?
Well, I mean, we've been especially recently been very much really trying to push the Democratic Party and question why they have utterly failed to mount any kind of response to what's going on in Washington right now. So we've looked at that definitely in how the Democrats, too, have been complicit in what's going on with all these corporate scandals. We've done a number of things related to offshore banking. We've had an ongoing series of investigations by a reporter named Lucy Komisar looking at how the international banking industry hides the type of crimes, the Enron-type crimes. We have a story in the current issue actually going all the way back to the Marcos era, Imelda and Ferdinand Marcos.
Ferdinand, yeah.
There we go.
Who could forget him?
And how these Swiss banks were hiding money, and then how that those same techniques are being used in these offshore banks to create shell companies, to hide money, to avoid taxes and all these other things. And I'd like to think that we've definitely been out front and that some of those scandals will be the ones that will be showing up in the mainstream media here in the next months.
Let's hope so. This is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. My guest today is Craig Aaron. This is a recorded show, so please don't try to call in. Just turn up the volume, sit back, and relax. Craig, if someone wants to find a copy of In These Times online to sort of check it out or learn more about the publication, what's the web address?
Our website is www.inthesetimes.com. That's INTHESETIMES. Also, if you're interested in subscribing, there is a 1995.
I don't think we're – are we allowed to do that?
No.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, why not? Sure. For 24 issues, you can also call. There's an 800 number, 1-800-827-0270. About half of the current issue should be available up on the website. Obviously, to get the full thing, you do need to subscribe, but it's updated every 2 weeks. And usually has some of the best stuff, so it's definitely worth checking out.
I've been talking all along about the creeping advertising on public radio, and here we are, another example.
We're a nonprofit.
Believe this, the money is not going to anyone rich. I can guarantee you, we're talking to Craig Aaron again of In These Times, the Chicago-based publication. Chicago. I mean, it's a very interesting part of In These Times because, as you pointed out, except for the progressive, virtually all the sort of alternative or independent media are based usually in New York, Boston, or the West Coast.
Sure.
What sort of relationship does In These Times have with the city of Chicago, or has it developed over the 25 years it's been there?
Well, it's sort of off and on, but it's definitely, I think, very much of Chicago. Particularly, I think where it really sort of cemented that relationship was during the Harold Washington campaign. In fact, there's a chapter in the book that touches on this quite a bit by John Nichols, where when Harold Washington was first running for mayor, the mainstream papers, the Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Sun-Times, they didn't take him seriously as a candidate. And basically the reason they didn't take him seriously was because he was black. And In These Times, at that time, was one of the few publications published locally that said, no, wait a minute, you know, look at the population of this city with, you know, these certain alliances. Harold Washington could absolutely win. And so it is, I think that was maybe the first time where In These Times really stood up and said, hey, we're a part of Chicago. And then over the years, you know, as the magazine has gone on and as the writers have gotten better known, some of them, they've become, you know, really a part of the community and, you know, gives us a much higher profile there than maybe we enjoy in some other cities.
But you're not a native Chicagoan, are you?
I am not. I've been there for about 8 or 9 years now. I actually came from Seattle before I came to Chicago and lived about 5 or 6 other states besides that.
Really?
We won't necessarily bore the listeners with that, but
Well, only if the show bottoms out, but hopefully it won't get
hopefully
to that
we're
point.
Not there yet.
But one thing I would like, you're a young guy, Craig. Our listeners obviously can't see you. What got you interested in politics and journalism? What got you interested in sort of socialist or left-wing politics to begin with?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I think I just came from what we would call a liberal family. You know, my mom campaigned for McGovern and things of that nature. They certainly weren't socialist, but there was definitely sort of a liberal and a social action or social work kind of perspective. And that just opened up, you know, doors to me just, you know, on a very basic level. I think how a lot of people first get into left politics is just sort of, you know, the basic ideas of justice. And when you see, you know, injustice happening, you want to know more about it. You know, I sort of came in a very strange route to the left press. I mean, you know, my sort of political awakening came in my high school years through a Jewish youth group of all things, you know, that was sort of very active in a number of things out on the West Coast in Seattle and Oregon and fighting some censorship issues that were going on in Seattle during my high school years and things of that nature. I went to Northwestern University, not a very left-leaning university, at least not at that time.
It is now.
You'd be surprised. Okay. I tell you, when I was there, the biggest protest was when they were going to move the student football seats. Within the last couple of years, they've had a hunger strike for Asian American studies. They've got a very active Students Against Sweatshops group that has pulled them, you know, out of the FLA and really done a lot of work. Very active. They publish their own alternative magazine there once a month now. I mean, none of that existed when I was a student there. But, you know, I actually went to journalism school. And, you know, the more I got into that, the more I realized that I did not want to be really part of the mainstream media. I did a brief stint at an alternative news weekly down in Memphis, Tennessee, and came back. And then the opportunity opened at In These Times, which, to be honest, I wasn't that familiar with. I mean, I'd seen it around, seen it in some academic, you know, in some classes. But there was an opportunity. I you know, went and started learning about the publication, was fortunate enough to be hired there. And then through various people leaving and whatnot, I sort of moved up the food chain.
Yeah, rapid advancement, isn't that? Yes. It's the great thing about the alternative press. If listeners out there are looking for like a chance for an executive position, it will not necessarily be well compensated, but you will have a very nice title.
That's right. If you work hard, let me say.
Now, I'd like to take a second here and read you something. I recently read by Jim Weinstein, the founder of In These Times and the very well-known American historian, and still quite active and writing quite a bit. And this is something he wrote. And it's a little long, but let me read it to you because I think it's interesting. He said, "The election returns are in, but the future of the United States remains in doubt. Almost everyone was dissatisfied with the available choices. Few were delighted with the result. And he goes on to write, "Capitalism is the unspoken reality of American politics. That is the one thing the major parties agree upon. Praise capitalism, not too often and preferably by another name, but don't discuss it. Preclude serious discussion of the central reality of our times. This is to be expected. The major parties are the protection agencies of corporate capitalism. They are committed in bipartisan consensus to accommodating government policy and public expectations to the capacities and limits of the system. It is their job to keep corporate capitalism out of, above, politics, just as it was the job of the pre-Civil War Whig and Democratic parties to keep slavery out of politics. They failed then because determined people brought the reality of slave power into the electoral arena, giving birth to the Republican Party. It remains to be seen whether the Democratic and Republican parties will succeed in keeping corporate power out of the electoral politics. If they do, they will only be doing their job, and socialists will not be doing theirs. That job is to bring capitalism into politics as the great issue of our time. This newspaper, referring to In These Times, is committed to beginning the job and seeing it through. It is a job whose time has come." That was written...
There you go, November 15th, 1976.
26 years ago, almost. The opening, first issue of In These Times, and I think almost without exception, each of those words could have been written and published in your most recent edition.
Absolutely.
Of In These Times. Nothing really has changed about that.
No,
if anything, I would say that the view of the Democratic Party, which has moved, as you've talked about, In These Times has grown even more critical of it. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
I would certainly say so. I mean, I think that people of the left right now are very, very disillusioned with the Democratic Party. And there's certainly very much an ongoing debate about whether a successful strategy can still be hatched within the party or whether there needs to something needs to go on outside of that. I mean, that's going on across the left. That's going on in the offices of In These Times. And these latest round of corporate scandals where you would just think that, you know, this is what the Democrats have been waiting for. Here's the opportunity for them to seize on an issue. Here's the opportunity to really get back to, you know, bread and butter economic themes that the party supposedly represents. And yet you've had almost silence, except with the most, the softest, most basic types of reforms, you know, that everyone, I mean, that passed the Senate 97-0. What the Democrats have done, absolutely nothing to differentiate themselves. And largely that's because they have to hide because they're just as guilty when it comes to taking money from these corporations, when it comes to passing the tax breaks and regulations and things that have allowed this type of, these crimes to happen.
Yet back in the 2000 election, as I recall, In These Times was not uniformly opposed to Al Gore's not candidacy for president and supporting Ralph Nader's Green Party. I mean, I sense the magazine then was split, if not indeed pro-Gore.
Well, the magazine was certainly split. The history of the magazine has always believed that the way to build the left movement was within one of the established parties. And the magazine very adamantly pushed for someone like Ralph Nader to run in the primaries and to pursue sort of a Jesse Jackson-esque strategy, if you will, of going to the primaries and getting your message out that way instead of launching an independent campaign. But there was definitely a split. I tell you, there is nothing that energized our readers more than the Nader versus Gore debate. The official editorial stance of the magazine did encourage people to support Gore and felt that Nader was making some tactical mistakes. There was a lot of debate within the building. I think what In These Times did do was take the Nader campaign very seriously, give it a lot of coverage and exposure, even, you know, in our small size. And in that way, you know, is willing to continue the debate. And certainly the Democrats aren't showing themselves to warrant a lot more support. But there's definitely a tactical debate. I think it'll go on. I think that it was very much complicated by the 2000 election. I think you're going to find a lot of people who were on the fence of voting for Nader, very hesitant because they're afraid they're going to cause another Florida. They're going to push the Bush administration, which, you know, has been so much worse than I think so many of us even imagined it would be.
What is the circulation of In These Times?
Oh, we're right around 20,000 circulation right now. We have about 20,000 readers. They're spread across the country. We obviously are a little bit bigger in the major metropolitan areas, Chicago, New York, San Francisco. We do well in college towns, Madison, hopefully Urbana-Champaign here. We've got a few people as well. So that's about it, about 20,000.
And how, over the years, has it gone up and down? Has it been fairly stable?
It has gone up and down. In the late 80s, it peaked at about 40,000 readers. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest size that In These Times ever had. It very much benefited in a strange way from the Reagan administration. It was one of the strongest times of the magazine. Right. And I think it benefited from being out front on a lot of stories, but also, honestly, from being outsiders, that the left came together a little bit because they were so under attack. It was a time, by the time Clinton came around, the left started to get a little bit confused. Some people went and even, literally worked in the administration. You know, they thought that was the direction, and that hurt the magazine. Of course, there was also the basic financial problems that do plague magazines like In These Times. However, the magazine's been as small as maybe 10,000 subscribers. So in the last several years, since 1999, I'd say, the magazine is actually up and moving in the right direction.
Is the current Bush administration helping circulation with all these issues you've been talking about, the election, the war on terrorism, the corporate
scandals? Yeah, I really
think
so. We didn't quite benefit from the huge boost that some of our fellow publications got right at the election. That was more of a product of our financial situation at the time. However, because we have been one of the few publications challenging the conventional wisdom and the company line coming from Washington, we're getting a lot of response to our coverage of the war in Afghanistan, certainly to our coverage of what's going on in Israel, because it's so different from the mainstream press by, talking about the Palestinians and the Palestinian cause.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. What is In These Times' position or stance on the Israel-Palestine issue?
Well,
I know you're Jewish. You've already referred to that.
Right.
How have you personally wrestled with this issue?
Well, it's obviously a very difficult issue being raised Jewish, and you're certainly taught a version of Israeli history, I do think the state of Israel should exist. I think that In These Times position fits in with that. I believe there's a piece in the book written in 1978 where James Weinstein writes that a true friend of Israel is a friend of Palestinian statehood, and it's impossible to be a friend of one and the enemy of the other. So that's really where In These Times comes down. They think there should be an independent Palestinian state, that the Palestinian people have a right to self-determination. And we have gone out of our way to report from the ground, from Israel, what's happening there and the atrocities, and to, obviously point out the atrocities of the suicide attacks and the suicide bombings, but also to look at what the Israeli army is doing and how the settlements continue to be built and how things are being limited for when there finally is a Palestinian state, and to be very, very critical of certainly the Sharon administration, but also the Barack administration, and absolutely the American complicity in all of that.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580. My guest here in the studio is Craig Aaron, the managing editor of In These Times, the Chicago-based weekly newspaper, and the editor of a new book, Appeal to Reason, 25 Years of In These Times, recently published by Seven Stories Press and available now in the finest bookstores in the country. And Craig is talking about In These Times, its history, which he is now, I guess, the resident archivist of, having compiled this book.
Yes, I've read every issue ever published, actually. I sat down with 1976, a big bound version, and read all the way through to the one that came out yesterday. So
that's interesting. How has it changed in 2016, outside of just the political changes, which we know about, but internally, the quality of publication, the nature of the writing, the spirit of it?
I, of course, would like to think that it's at its best right now, or at least in the last several years. It's been interesting. I think some of the debates within the left movement have changed as sort of the left has changed. You can look at a word like socialism and how that sort of, I don't know whether the meaning has changed, but certainly the use has changed. The magazine used to be identified as the Independent Socialist Weekly.
Yeah, when did it drop socialism?
Sometime during the late 80s, I mm-hmm. believe. Could have been as late as, 90. Mm-hmm. But right around there, I think, with sort of what was going on in Eastern Europe and there, and the staff felt, I wasn't there when the decision was made, but felt that, maybe that didn't need to be on the cover.
Had In These Times been in its history a supporter of Eastern European-style communism? Had that been part of its political?
No, not at all. It had very much a social democratic type of orientation.
Yeah, that's probably confusing for a lot of people because you hear terms like socialist.
Ask social me to explain that. Yeah, I'm in trouble.
No, don't worry. And it won't be on the final exam for those of you at home. But a term like the left, you've used that term several times. Mm-hmm. And some people use it to mean one thing and other people other thing. When you use the term left, as you've used it, who are you talking about in our society?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to use it, I would say, in its broadest sense, which would be, as it says on the inside of every issue of In These Times, liberty and justice for all, and those people who support that, which I think includes, traditionally, the constituencies are the labor movement, certainly are those people who identify with, socialism or other left-wing views. I think you're talking about a big chunk of the Democratic Party. I think you're talking about a lot of African Americans and Latinos and other minorities. I think you're, talking about people who believe that government should play a role in society that betters it for the average person. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in very simple ways, that's sort of what In These Times is appealing.
Well, that's a radical idea, isn't it?
So there you go. I mean, these days, not just bettering it for corporations. And and that's why I think a publication like In These Times does survive, because there are a lot of people who believe that, and also because really, the general public believes it. They just haven't necessarily heard it put that way maybe before.
Now, what about the In These Times plays off the conventional news media. You pick up stories
sure.
they don't cover. You hope they will pick them up. From your sense of doing the history of In These Times, have you sensed a change in the quality or nature of mainstream press coverage over the last 20 or 25 years? Because you referred to mm-hmm. A few minutes ago how terrible you think the coverage has been of the big issues recently, corporate scandals, 2000 election, war on terrorism. Do you think they would have done a better job 20 years ago?
Well, I think there might have been when there was a greater diversity of voices. I mean, it's tough to say. I mean, I think as the left grows stronger, it does force some issues into the mainstream press. So at a time like In These Times was founded in 1976, you were still getting, post-Watergate, anti-Vietnam War movement. And so that there were some issues being forced onto the mainstream agenda. There have been other times where that wasn't the case at all. And I think as we do fall into fewer and fewer hands as the media consolidates, that it's even harder. I mean, it's very rare that you see someone reaching that works for a left-wing publication on a Sunday morning talk show. It's almost non-existent. You might see them during the week on cable. But if you work for the National Review, a publication which I believe is much smaller than The Nation, maybe half its size, the Weekly Standard, which is a little bit smaller, but yet they're everywhere. So I do think it's getting harder and harder for the stories.
So it's a double standard for opinion magazines.
Certainly, absolutely.
And the right.
Well, because of what they're saying. I mean, a magazine like In These Times is challenging the corporate ideal. And that's not very popular with those, with big corporations. And big corporations own our media outlets. So it's harder and harder to find someone, of left-wing views. Why should they give them the space?
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Craig Aaron again, managing editor of In These Times, and also the editor of the new book, Appeal to Reason, 25 Years of In These Times, that just came out. Let's talk about this book. You said you read every issue of In These Times
that.
And put it together. And what was the idea behind the book?
Well, when we first sat down and we saw that the 25th anniversary was coming up, we decided we didn't simply want to publish a collection of clips over the years, because we figured people didn't really want to read a bunch of old stories necessarily. Instead, what we did is that I approached about 25 of my favorite contributors to the magazine on a whole host of topics, everything from globalization to Russian politics to the environment to feminism to culture, and asked them to look at the past 25 years, to draw on the lessons of the past 25 years, and also, suggest some directions for the future. Where do we go from here on all these topics? Then once I had assigned those essays to all of the different writers, I did go through all of the archives, and I picked out selections that I felt really fit in with the themes raised by the essayists, and so tried to look at how In These Times had covered these various issues. Sometimes that meant covering a big event, maybe the LA riots in 92, so that got in. But sometimes, it was a small event, a candidate running, something that just really got at, when the left was doing something very right, maybe when the right was doing something very wrong, whatever the case might be. And then so I inserted into each chapter. When you see the book, there's an essay running through, and then there are sidebars, essentially, stories that just sort of get at some of those themes and show some of the best writing and best writers that have also been in the magazines over the years. Some of those people have gone on to sort of bigger and better things, if you will. Many of them hold jobs in the mainstream media now. Some of them are, Noam Chomsky, well-known thinkers.
Well, let's go through the book a little
sure.
bit and talk about some of the sections and themes and some of the contributors, because you're right, it's a pretty impressive lineup. The first section is called A New Majority, and the capstone essay there is written by John B. Judas, one of the most famous names and probably controversial names in In These Times history. A little bit about John Judis.
Well, John Judis first met Jim Weinstein when they were both editors, or I guess Jim was the editor and John was a writer at Socialist Revolution. For about the first 15 years of In These Times,
I wonder if John's taken that off his resume.
Undoubtedly. I mean, readers may be familiar with John's work. I mean, he now writes predominantly for The New Republic. He also writes for The American Prospect. He's written for GQ in the past. I mean, he's you know, honestly been one of the people who've gone on to quite a bit of success in the mainstream journalism world. But for about the first 15 years of In These Times, John wrote a lot for the magazine, served as its Washington correspondent for a number of years, where I think he really excelled at the magazine. And he was a very controversial section because he did get much more conservative during his tenure, but was particularly in his coverage of the right. And he was very good at covering right-wing movements and recognizing, you know, where that was rising and, you know, being one of the first to really hone in on the idea of sort of the Reagan Democrat and recognizing that Reagan, that's where Reagan was going to get his strength and really make the difference in his first election. And was really on top of those number of those trends. But because of his history with the magazine, I did approach him to write something for the 25th anniversary. The piece he wrote, while certainly not the most radical piece in the book, you know, does talk about whether a, you know, left-wing, left-leaning majority is possible. And in fact, as he argues, he thinks it is actually emerging. People that, you know, believe in a more government involvement in social justice and things like that, and that's where the country is trending. If now John and I might disagree on exactly how far to the left, say, the Democratic Party should go. But, I mean, I think he brings an interesting historical perspective. The other thing that he talks about a lot is the way Washington lobbying has changed over the years and how back in 1976, when In These Times was starting, you weren't really seeing the National Association of Manufacturers, the Chamber of Commerce. They were just beginning to enter Washington and become a real major player, and just how radically those lobbying groups have transformed the way the game is really played.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I remember back in the 80s when he was writing there, he was one of the few writers on the left who was fairly much in favor of the Reagan wars in Central America, and he would write about that in These Times. And your letters pages would be filled almost every issue with people canceling their subscriptions because of John Judis.
Yeah. Well, you know, it always sometimes helps to, I think, tell people not always necessarily what they want to hear. I mean, John Judis and I certainly don't agree across the spectrum, although I think if you are going to have a broad left, a left that can win, that it does include people like John Judis. I mean, the book starts with John Judis. The book ends with a guy named David Graeber, who's a professor at Yale and who is an anarchist, you know, very much part of the Direct Action Network and Ya Basta and these Italian groups that have been, you know, very prominent in Genoa. I think, and why I asked them both to contribute is because I do think that that left that actually will be a majority it does include both of them.
Well, I think that's very much the In These Times position from the beginning, going back to Appeal to Reason. It's a very broad group.
Right.
Basically, if you're not part of the owning class, you're part of the solution.
Sure. I mean, and the Appeal to Reason certainly believe that, and they open their pages to not just people who are members, you know, of the Socialist Party, but, you know, a much wider spectrum.
Well, going on here, the second section is on the right wing again, which, I mean, really is one of the great stories of the last 25 years. It's been the ascension of the political right.
Mm-hmm.
And your lead essay is written by another well-known writer, Rick Perlstein, who wrote the highly acclaimed biography of Barry Goldwater.
Right. And the essay here really picks up a lot of what Rick did in researching his Barry Goldwater book. But it really looks at how the right essentially stole the left's playbook, if you will, and how they took some of the things that the left had done very successfully, particularly, I mean, essentially with organizing, and then used those same techniques to build up, you know, the right strength. There's a piece that I ran as a sidebar there, actually written by a guy named Sidney Blumenthal, who has since gone on to some infamy as a member of the Clinton administration. But why I like the piece so much is it's a piece where he goes and interviews Richard Viguerie, the Republican political strategist, and he's there, and it's right at the beginning of direct mail, and this is the guy who really got Jesse Helms elected several times, I mean, by going across the country to raise money for him and things of this nature, and really for the first one to use computers. And on his desk, he's got a copy of all of the McGovern for President materials from 1972. And really what the conservatives learned is they were planning for a revolution, and they took a lot of that rhetoric and a lot of those organizing skills and used it very successfully you know, one of the things that Rick Perlstein argues is it's time for us to take that back. The other thing he talks a lot about is the idea that the center is not always right and or correct, that is,
mm-hmm.
And that how the liberal media, the mainstream media, sort of the new republics of the world, really missed out on most of the big stories of the last 20 years because they were so convinced that they were right and sort of this technocratic, bureaucratic hypothesis was right and that was going to lead us to this greater place. But instead what happened, of course, is that we shifted very far to the right and the right very successfully argued. And he traces that lineage, you know, back to the John Birch Society.
Yeah, there's a wonderful anecdote that Perlstein tells in his essay, excuse me, where he talks about how back in the early 60s when the Young Americans for Freedom, the Barry Goldwater far-right mm-hmm. Wing organizing group, the youth group that was organizing, would meet in a coffee house or bar in Greenwich Village in Manhattan, along with the new leftists. And these guys would drink together and argue politics and talk. But there was a camaraderie almost of shared interests in politics.
Right, exactly. That, you know, he sort of argues that those on the fringe are really the ones who care and therefore... What the right did very successfully was take that fringe and move it toward the middle and build and organize at the grassroots. I mean, the Christian Coalition is an obvious example, although there are more. And meanwhile, the left, I think you'll find, you know, there's a number of the essayists, I think, argue was busy fighting with itself and excommunicating people and really getting lost in mm-hmm. the culture wars and the academy and things. And they forgot about that. And suddenly they found themselves on the losing end. And, you know, and that's something in these times I think is really pushed against, you know, in its own small way.
Here's another writer who does one of your capstone pieces. Can Feminism Break Through the Class Ceiling, it's called, or Doing It for Ourselves, written by Barbara Ehrenreich.
Sure.
Tell us about Barbara Ehrenreich.
Well, Barbara Ehrenreich certainly is becoming well known. I believe she's got a book, you know, in its 50th week on the bestseller list or something, nickel and dimed. You know, Barbara is a writer who has a background as a sociologist and has written, you know, a number of, I guess, seminal works over the years. Her piece for my book looks at whether sort of feminism has really succeeded, and it's looked at the way as the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, as the divide widens, whether feminism can work with that. In other words, she sort of uses the example of going back to the 70s and being at a university where the secretaries and the professors could get together and talk about their shared common experiences as women. But now maybe the professors are making so much more money that the secretaries, can they still have that same conversation? And then it's time for people who consider themselves feminists to begin thinking about the class aspects of that and not just the health aspects or, you know, that really in a lot of ways the feminist revolution, if you will, has benefited the upper.
You must have had a pretty hard copyediting job with people like Perlstein and Ehrenreich as you're writing for you.
A few of them made it easier than others, yeah, we'll say that.
If I'm being facetious, there are a lot of terrific writers in here, though, to put it mildly. Another section here I see, Colorblind, Radicalism and the Black Freedom Struggle, History of Black Politics, and almost all the entries but one are by the same person who wrote the capstone piece, one of the great In These Times reporters for the past 20 years, Salim Muakil. And I think many of our listeners are familiar with him because of the column he writes first for the Sun-Times, not for the Trib. What does Salim argue, though? Give a sense of what he's talking about.
Well, Salim sort of talks about the failure of radical ideas to really take hold in the black community after, you know, groups like the Black Panthers, the Black Power Movement, you know, sort of diminished largely because of government involvement to really shut them down. But there hasn't really been a radical black movement. And he gets into a lot about how often in the black community what radicalism ends up meaning is black nationalism, is through groups like the Nation of Islam and their various offshoots.
Was Salim a member of the Nation?
At one point he was a member of the Nation. He has sort of a long history, actually sort of post-Black Panthers. He was a Black Panther coming out of the long hot summer and all the riots, which he was covering as a journalist. He then got involved with the Nation of Islam as a journalist. He edited Muhammad Speaks at one point and worked for there. He's no longer a member of the Nation of Islam. He's sort of in a different spiritual place, I think, is what he would say. But he's one of the few journalists to really, I think, understand the group, to have, you know, many connections there, and I think to appreciate, you know, why Farrakhan and others have such a resonance in the black community. However, he is also very critical of the Nation of Islam because it is so inherently conservative, that the ideas that it puts forth are very much of, you know, a certain family structure and whatnot, the men must lead, things of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Salim really calls for a black radical alternative. There's a group he's involved with called the Black Radical Congress that sort of had a brief flash, like maybe they were going to be the ones. It was largely a group of academics and sort of labor movement officials, and it never really has managed to sort of latch on at a more grassroots level. But I think Salim is optimistic, looking at the hip-hop community and a lot of young black America, that they are looking for another alternative, and that, you know, it's really time for those in the black community who are aware, you know, of more radical ideas to really begin pushing those.
Next section, return of Juan Seguin, Latinos and the Remaking of American Politics. Juan Gonzalez writes the capstone essay.
Sure. Juan is a columnist for the New York Daily News, also a host of a show called Democracy Now!, which is a competing show? No, I don't know.
No. In public radio, we don't compete. We're all comrades.
Juan, again, takes off from a book that he wrote a couple of years ago on the history of Latinos in America, one of the few people to really study that history, certainly for a popular audience. And Juan really points out how our country is changing. When you look at the census data that just came out, you find that suddenly, Latinos are as big a part of our population in this country as are African Americans. And he really challenges the left in this essay to recognize that, to realize that it is not simply a black-white dichotomy in this country anymore, and that if the left does want to succeed, that it very much needs to reach out to the Latino community and recognize their strength, and also recognize that the right isn't going to hesitate to reach out to that community, and that will present some interesting challenges. Mm-hmm. He also talks a lot about sort of how that group has grown and their political awareness is changing, largely through the amount of Latinos who are becoming citizens. You know, mm-hmm. previously, most Mexican immigrants, for example, did not become citizens because they plan to go back to Mexico at some point. But that has all changed, especially in the backlash to what happened in the 90s, particularly in California. With a lot of anti-immigrant legislation, you've seen just a very strong backlash, and most of the new citizens that are coming in this country now are coming from Central America, Mexico, Central America, South America.
We've got here another section, Pride in Politics. Whatever happened to gay liberation? Doug Ireland wrote the capstone essay. This has been an issue throughout the history of In These Times. Or has it?
It has, and you can go back and see.
Doesn't sound
coverage.
Like you're very convinced, though.
Well, I to be honest, you know, it was there were certain issues that In These Times probably didn't cover as well.
And that's one of them?
I would say that that's one of them. I would say that at various times the Latino community was certainly one of them, where that's improved substantially. But, you know, back in 1976, the left was not necessarily interested in issues of gay liberation. There's a piece I reprint from the 1977 where a columnist at the time, a guy named Joshua Dressler, he's a law professor in Ohio now, where he really calls out the left for its failure to embrace the gay liberation movement, gay rights, if you will. What Doug gets at is how that changed and how the meaning of that had changed, that the earliest people to come out to really claim a gay identity were very much radicals. They'd come out of the labor movement, many out of the anti-war movement, and that how sort of the nature of that has changed as it's become a human rights issue instead of a much stronger word like liberation, that's changed, that the commercialization of the gay community has really had some negative effects on its ability to really change things politically.
So under the Aaron regime, but in these times, you're seeing a little more attention to gay politics.
Well, I would hope that we're doing a better job. I think that, I mean, you can always do a better job with any of these communities. But I think certainly, the society has changed a lot, certainly. I think that you had a lot of old lefties at the time In These Times was for me who were very uncomfortable with the gay liberation movement. But I'd say now, the number of people on the In These Times staff are gay or lesbian, and I think we're doing a lot better job of covering those issues.
And then a couple more I want to talk about in the few minutes we have remaining, because they're really, one of them at least, is one of the longtime and really important In These Times writers. David Moberg, is there still power in a union? labor coverage has really been central to In These Times from the beginning. I think that's a safe statement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, In These Times has always believed that if the left is ever going to, you know, be a majority here in this country, that the labor movement is going to have to be part of that. And in these times, has been very committed. I think it's one of the things, and David Moberg deserves almost all of the credit for that.
Now, where's David Moberg based?
He's based in Chicago.
And does he write exclusively for In These Times?
No, or? I mean, you'll occasionally see his stuff in The Nation, in The American Prospect, occasionally online, Salon, back when they were paying people. He wrote there for a while. And but he writes in every issue of In These Times. He's one of our senior editors, along with Salim.
How long has he been writing for In
These
Times?
He's actually been a member of the staff since before the first issue was published. So for 25 years, he has written in just about, I mean, there were a few vacations in there, but just about every issue of the magazine. And he focuses, as well as Salim, they both actually write two chapters of the book.
Mm-hmm.
David has also become quite an expert on globalization, anti-globalization issues. The labor movement is really something that In These Times, and there was obviously, I guess, a split on the left coming out of the 60s. A lot of the labor movement very much supported the Vietnam War, and In These Times, I think, was one of the first places, you may have to correct me if my history is wrong here, but to really say, you know, for the left to succeed, the labor movement has to be a part of that movement.
And then let's, lastly but not least, Jeffrey St. Clair, The Changing Face of Environmentalism, one of the great movements we haven't talked about over the past 25 years. The environmental movement, and what's St. Clair's essay argue, and who is St. Clair?
Jeffrey St. Clair is an investigative reporter. He's based out of Oregon. You'll see he writes for a number of publications, like In These Times. He also edits a publication called Counterpunch, along with a guy named Alex Coburn, a lot of people are probably familiar with, columnist for The Nation. But Jeff's background is as an investigative reporter. He's done a number of stories, particularly on government corruption, especially when it comes to national parks and things like that. He was out front on a lot of nuclear waste stories. The Hanford stands out as one of them. A lot of development in Alaska, very out front on the Anwar story, things of that nature. This chapter really charts how the environmental movement has changed over 25 years.
For the better or for the worse?
Both, I guess. Mm-hmm. Both. I think he looks at how its origins, a lot of it coming in anti-nuclear demonstrations and things of that nature through the environmental justice movement, particularly as shown Love Canal. He looks at how various events have really spurred new developments in the environmental movement, whether it's Chernobyl or, I guess, in Three Mile Island first, then Chernobyl, Love Canal, the destruction of the spotted owl and rainforest and things like that.
And Craig, I think we've got to stop now. I just want to say that's only five of like 25 chapters.
That's
there are
right.
A number
You'll find
of other
a lot
great
more.
Writers. John Nichols is in here, who we've had on the show, Fred Weir, James North, Paul Hockenos, Chris Lehman, Joel Bleifuss, Pat Ofterheide. The list goes on and on. It's really a terrific book. It's called Appeal to Reason, 25 Years of In These Times. Our guest today has been the managing editor of In These Times and the editor of the book, Craig Aaron, who's graciously joined us here in the studio. Thank you very much, Craig.
And thanks so much for having me on.
And I would like to ask you all to join us one week from today to hear Larry Lessig, our guest, talk about the future of the Internet. And I want to thank Ben Byrne, who has been a wonderful producer for the past month of the program. I'm Bob McChesney. See you next week.